Let's start with our motivation. Several people have mentioned this week the disturbing world events, challenging us to keep our minds stable. And in reflecting and studying on this chapter, it's so clear that whether it's viruses taking over countries that have the capacity to decimate parts of the world, whether it's conflict in places where people have been fighting forever, not forever, for a long time. Conflicts in the Middle East, conflicts among people in Europe. Whether it's illness at home, whether it's conflicts between families and community members, all of it, every single bit of suffering that exists boils down to our grasping at true existence. Our taking in the appearance of true existence that appears to our senses and believing it to be true. And then the self-centered thought that rises up right behind it, because we've grasped the self that we see as also be truly existent, and defending it to the death, literally, again and again and again. Absolutely the cause of every suffering, every difficulty, every challenge that we can imagine that's ever been. And as Arya Davis says to us in some of the verses, in one of the verses we'll get to tonight, that even to have a doubt about the existence of these things that appear to us as real, as truly existent, tears samsara to tatters. So just thinking about how in the world did we create the causes to be able to hear enough teaching to begin to raise that doubt. Through the kindness of the Buddhas, through the kindness of our teachers, and through our own past causes, through our own effort in creating merit, we've brought ourselves to a situation where we can hear the teachings that begin to raise our doubt. And we are surrounded by people, care about people, love people who don't have any question in their minds. And yet their suffering is deep and profound and moves us. So as we review this chapter and as we take advantage of the precious opportunity we have with this human life that we have right now, with all the conditions, circumstances to practice the Dharma, let's make this dedication motivation to use the opportunity as fully and deeply as we can, to examine the teachings on the nature of reality and to cultivate our bodhicitta so that we raise serious doubt, that our doubt turns into conviction, and that we come to realize the true nature of reality. And we cultivate that wisdom and we cultivate our bodhicitta until omniscience arises, and therefore be of benefit and relieve all beings of all sufferings. So let's set that foundation. Okay, so Venerable Chodron is still, she's back, but she's just back from a very fast full trip. So we're continuing with the review of chapter 8 that we started last week. And do not expect that we will finish chapter 8 this week. That will give us plenty more to do the next time Venerable Chodron travels, because it's juicy, juicy stuff. Some people need to know that we've been receiving teachings on Arya Deva's 400 stanzas on the Middle Way. For about a year and a half. Anyway, a good long time. And while Venerable Chodron is in chapter 12 now, I think we are, We're reviewing the last time we left the reviews off, so we're looking at chapter 8. And the 8th chapter is the last chapter on the method side of the path before we go into the teachings on the wisdom side. So the title of this present chapter is Showing the Methods of Fully Training the Student's Mind Stream, Making It Receptive to the Development of Spiritual Paths. And it is a juicy, juicy chapter. She taught on it for months, many times. Some of these verses she taught 3 times. Some of them she taught twice, going back and reviewing, and partly because she was traveling in between, but partly because they're so potent. Sometimes she would just start a teaching with, I want to go back to that verse that we did last week because it's so powerful. So there's a lot of material. And the more I've studied it, the more I have also come to see that this is powerful stuff. So last week we got about halfway through verse 178 where we were talking about conceptuality. So I want to review just a little bit, and we'll pick up in the middle of that verse and then go forward for a while. So this is a section that's talking about how afflictions can be eliminated, which is a very, very important topic, because if we don't believe that our mental afflictions can be eliminated and subdued, then we won't bother to try to eliminate and subdue them. And if we don't try to eliminate them and subdue them, then we will be in cyclic existence forever, I think is a fair way to put it. I mean, until we make the decision that we want to subdue them and then eliminate them, we will be in cyclic existence. That's absolutely true. So as long as we think our anger and greed and insecurity are an inherent part of us, then we won't try to get rid of them. So this chapter on seeing that the afflictions can be eliminated is very, very important. So what it comes down to is realizing that the faults that are in our mind, the afflictions in our mind that we believe so strongly, you know, our anger is so real when it's up. Our craving, our attachment is so real when it's up. We think it's so much who we are, our fear. We can't imagine really that it's just an overlay on the pure nature of our mind. But that's really all it is. Not only is it just an overlay on the pure nature of our mind, but it just hasn't made its way into the pure nature of the mind, that if we just keep doing it long enough, it's finally going to penetrate and ruin us forever, which is what we kind of, in the back of our mind, might think. It's never going to penetrate the pure nature of our mind. It's not who we are. It's not innate. It's not inherent to who we are. And so they can be eliminated. And when we know this, I would think when we really have that conviction, when we really know that, then nothing would stop our practice. I think we would really be on fire. So this chapter is really maybe kindling a little fire for us. So last week, one of the things that we recognized, how is it that we can eliminate afflictions? So one of the verses showed us that afflictions are unstable because their objects are unstable, meaning that if you can see that this clock, for example, someone might look at it and see it's very, very beautiful and develop huge attachment to it. I might listen to it tick while we're trying to meditate and develop huge aversion to it. Somebody else might just, you know, be confused by the whole idea or, you know. So the affliction is arising not because of the clock. Same with this chair, actually. I realized as we were sitting here, this chair has become the gold standard for the chairs that the Abbey should have in our dining room. It was a $2.50 used furniture store purchase that is like the perfect chair, and there's no other one in the universe as far as we can find. But somebody else might sit in this chair and just hate it. Right? So the affliction is not, the object itself is not stable.
And furthermore, the affliction itself is not stable. So that's one of the things that we determined from last week's review. Then we also began discussing this whole thing about conceptuality. So that was in verse 178, where Aryadeva says, apart from conceptuality, desire and so forth have no existence. Who with intelligence would hold that there are real things imputed by conceptuality? Okay, so we talked last time that conceptuality here has a couple of different meanings. One is just labeling things and how things exist depending on having a name or a label. You know, conceiving them and then naming them. That's one kind of conceptuality. Another meaning of conceptuality ties into this mental factor of inappropriate attention. And it's inappropriate attention that fabricates all kinds of things on top of the object, right? And so it's inappropriate attention, Venerable Children said, that is the thing that makes the four distortions distorted, that sees impermanent phenomena as permanent, that sees the foul as clean, you know, that sees the what's in the nature of dukkha as being happiness or pleasure, and that sees what has no intrinsic existence as having self. But that's inappropriate attention, she said. And she said it a couple of times. So this kind of conceptuality puts an overlay on objects and imputes traits or qualities that they don't have or exaggerates what they do have. And then this happens all the time. Okay, so given that, Geltsup, who is our commentator on this text, he says, afflictions can't be found apart from conceptualizations of inappropriate attention or apart from the imputation by conceptuality, which is what I just said. That is, giving a name to an object, just as a snake is imputed to a coiled rope. So we talked a lot about inappropriate attention last week. Do we need to do that again? Is it helpful to talk about it? Okay. So, inappropriate attention, Venerable said, is conceptuality at its worst. So we have these two kinds, several kinds, but two kinds that we've identified here. This one's the worst. Because this is the one that makes things up that don't exist and then believes that they do. That's how this famous example of the rope and the snake applies here. Our mind is making stuff up all the time. And it's what fools us, right? It's what fools us. So I went back and looked at, when Guy Newlin is here, he was talking about the rope snake example too. And he says, you know, every time everybody hears rope snake, their eyes glaze over. They've all heard this example. And he says, and besides, nobody's ever actually mistaken a rope for a snake anyway, so how is this real? So I came up with an example from my own life. It's from way long ago, but this may help. So when I was about 7 years old, life-size dolls were kind of the rage. 36-inch tall, I mean, they were big. And I don't know where my parents got the money for this, but one Christmas, when I was seven, my sister and I both got one. My sister's was kind of blonde, and mine was dark. You know. So one day, my mother came into she's cooking dinner or something, and she came into the living room, and she had seen that my sister's bed wasn't made, and she was quite irritated about it. So she came downstairs, and my sister was sitting in front of the television. And Mom said, Patty, go upstairs and make her bed. And Patty just sat there and watched the TV screen. And Mom said, Patty, get up and make your bed. And Patty just sat there watching the TV screen. My mom is starting to get furious, right? It's Nancy Patricia, pay attention when I'm talking to you. Patty just sits there and stares at the TV screen. So Mom comes over, like ready to pull her up, and it's the doll. What does my mother do? My mother burst out laughing. That was her character. She burst out laughing and then told the story for 50 years. But it's exactly the same example. Right? Imputing Patty on that doll is exactly the same example as imputing snake on a modeled rope. So on the modeled rope example, they'll tell you the parts of the rope are not the snake. That which possesses the parts are not the snake. The continuum of the rope is not the snake, and that which possesses the continuum is not the snake. None of the collections of conditions, color, shape, darkness, none of it is a snake. So the parts of the doll were not Patty. That which possessed the parts of the doll were not Patty. The continuum of the doll was not Patty. That which possesses the continuum was not my sister. So you can impute a girl on a doll and get really furious, but there's absolutely nothing there that is the girl. Nothing in the parts, possesses the parts, the continuum of what possesses the continuum. So, similarly, our collection of aggregates, we see them, we conceive them, and then we impute this person on them. The collection of the aggregates is not the person. What makes up the collection is not the person. The continuum of the collection of the aggregates is not the person. And that which possesses the continuum is not the person. So we can conceive them, we can impute person, we can think I, but there is no inherently existent person there. Why? Because the person exists dependently. And that's the point. The person being imputed on dependence and its aggregates doesn't exist from its own side. And this is the same for all phenomena, including the afflictions. So it's not just the person. It's not just the snake or the not snake. It's not just the doll or the not doll. It's not just the girl or the not girl. The afflictions too. Everything. That's a mind-boggling. So even a beautiful thing we're attached to, the beautiful thing exists dependently, the attachment itself exists dependently. Not stable. So, again, and this is where we left off, I think, when we use the rope snake example, or the girl doll example, there's an important difference that we have to keep in mind continually, or we'll get really messed up. When we label a snake on a coiled rope, there is no snake there at all. It's completely invented. No rope can function as a snake. When we impute person on the collection of aggregates, it doesn't mean that there's no person there at all. It doesn't mean that the person is non-existent. It means that if you use ultimate analysis, you can't find the person. Right? So what's the difference? The difference is that when you impute the snake on the rope, or you impute the doll on the girl, the rope and the doll cannot function as the things that we've confused them as. However, if you impute an inherently existent person on the aggregates, that conventionally existent person that's there does function in that way. So this was always my question, and maybe I'll ask Ashitake to talk about this some more when he's here. But so my question has always been, so then what's the point of this story?
Could they use the snake and inherent existence to get the same point?
Yes, they probably could, but I think it would have been more confusing. Because what Jhansi Trigen Rinpoche said is that the point is that the process of designation is exactly the same. So the process of mental fabrication, fabricating an inherently existent person on the aggregates, and fabricating a snake on a rope, or fabricating my sister on the doll, that process of fabrication is exactly the same.
And one's erroneous and one's mistaken?
Right. One's erroneous and one is mistaken. Because... I think they're both erroneous. Actually, that's right. They're both erroneous.
There isn't. No. Because there's no inherently existent person.
There's no inherently existent person there. But it's mistaken in terms of its appearing object. Actually, yes, I think she's right, although I'm getting in territory where I don't have notes, so I should be careful. But I think she's right. That the it's mistake. The snake, there's no way there's a snake there. That is a completely erroneous, even a valid cognizer will not, I mean, you can't validate that. But the conventionally existent person is there. So it's mistaken in terms of that appearing object because it doesn't exist inherently, but it does function as person. That's right. And that's where those three criteria come in terms of being able to analyze what makes it function. I mean, how do we know? So this is really from, I went back to Jay Rinpoche's text rather more than what Trungpa Rinpoche said. So if it's known to a conventional consciousness, it operates with how things happen conventionally. In that case, the person does. The doll or the snake or the rope do not. The existence of such an eye is not contradicted by any conventional valid knowledge, or the existence of such an object is not contradicted by any conventional valid knowledge. That's the second one. So nobody else could come in and say, oh yeah, you're wrong. That really is a snake. You're wrong, that really is a girl. It really is conventionally existent person. And then the third one is the existence of such an eye, of such an object is not contradicted by any valid knowledge investigating the ultimate. Which it won't, because a valid knowledge investigating the ultimate is only going to see the ultimate. It's not going to see conventional reality in general. So it's worth, I think this is important to really, I'm stumbling through it here, but to really think about the process of conceptuality in both those cases is exactly the same, to see how that operates in our minds. And then to test, then, what are we believing in? Because, I mean, this is important. I underlined it, and Venerable said it too. All phenomena are imputed by conceptuality, but not all phenomena imputed actually exist. For example, when we say, so-and-so insulted me, and we're all totally bent out of shape and upset and, you know, telling all our friends and trashing that person and creating lots of negative karma, we have to stop and assess, you know, that whole, even the idea of being insulted is a pure conception of our mind. We have interpreted words, created a whole scene, created a whole scenario. This whole thing of conceptuality is invented by our own mind. So to think about the process of, with such a kind of a, you know, a glaze over example, as Guy characterized it, you know, it's such an obvious example of, like, who would mistake a rope for a snake? Well, I could, because I'm afraid of snakes, so I'm already predisposed to have that kind of conception. Well, that's an interesting thing to be aware of, too. I see that having this predisposition to even have that affliction makes it even more likely, right? And that's an interesting thing to think about. So this other example from my life, I know I've told the story of the community before, but when I was on the first Vajrasattva retreat, my only Vajrasattva retreat, actually, when we were in Canada, 12 people from Dharma Friendship Foundation went to a retreat center near Whistler with Venerable Chodron as their spiritual guide. Towards the end of retreat, and we kept silence really well. So before the end, towards the end of the retreat, we're 3 months into it, everybody's been living pretty well. There are about 12 people living in quite a small house. And on one snowy, snowy day, it was a break time or something, and everybody was kind of looking out at the snow. One of the retreatants picked up a camera and aimed it at somebody who was looking out the window in silhouette. It was really quite a lovely shot. Click. Another person, completely different person, who was studying, immediately assumed that the photo had been taken of her. And she was livid. But we're in total silence, right? She stands up, slams this thing, you know, slams the table, runs upstairs, and the weight of this person's anger is just like taking up the whole room. Bang, 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 bang. We hear upstairs for a while, then we sit down for a medicine meal. She comes down the stairs, slams a note in front of the person who took the photo. She picks up the note, opens it, bursts into tears, runs out of the room. The other person runs out of the house. They've all gone off to the hills, and everybody is like, over something that did not happen. I know that this happens all day long. I know it happens in my life all day long, but just because of the silence and the framework of the retreat, you could just watch it and, I mean, we were all like, ah! You just watch it and go, oh my gosh, we do this all day long. All day long, all the time. No wonder we're all so... It's crazy. Crazy. So, looking at conceptuality, that things are dependent on causes that include inappropriate attention, as a big one, and that things are dependent on designation. Then Gyaltsev Jay goes and he brings in this verse from Nagarjuna in 60 stanzas of reasoning. The world is caused by ignorance. The fully awakened one said so. Therefore, why is it not feasible to say that the world is conceptuality? I don't know, it seems pretty feasible to me. Jangse Chogyam Rinpoche said, the Buddha has taught that the world, and this could be either the external world, but specifically he's referring to the aggregates. The aggregates are caused by ignorance. So that's referring to the 12 links of dependent origination. Ignorance is the first link. That ignorance leads to volitional action, karma. Karma leads to consciousness. Consciousness needs to, name and form, taking a body and a mind at conception. And then from that, the six sense sources grow. From that comes what contact is next, and then feeling and craving and grasping, and existence, and then, birth, aging, death. Here we go. Boom, 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 boom. Ignorance, according to the Buddha, the world is caused by ignorance. Yeah, I just said this. Aggregates appear. It's an interesting statement. The aggregates appear through the force of mental afflictions and karma. Through the force of mental afflictions and karma. And the person is designated upon these five aggregates out of the force of ignorance. Ignorance causes the person to accumulate karma by the force of misapprehending things. La la la. Thus you can say the world is caused by ignorance. The fully awakened one said so. And he said it quite clearly. Then Nagarjuna says, therefore, why is it not feasible to say the world is conceptuality? So that part of the verse is talking about the fact that everything exists dependent on name and concept. So this again is showing those two. I think the whole point of bringing this verse into the commentary here is to show again the two aspects of conceptuality. So one dependent on imputation by conceptuality, i.e. you know, things existing dependent on term and concept. And then the second one, dependent on causes, chiefly here, inappropriate attention. Then Venerable said, concluding this verse, on one of the three times she taught this verse, ignorance is conceptuality. Whether that's technically true, I can't imagine that she wouldn't say if it's not, but in terms of like how we think about it, ignorance is conceptuality because it superimposes something that isn't there on the object. So it has a causal function. And then once the conceptual mind gives the name and label, ignorance thinks that the labeled object is the basis of designation. So it's ignorance that superimposes, so it has the causality. Then the conceptual mind gives the name and the label, and then ignorance fuses those two things. It cannot see the basis of designation, the bases of designation, the label, and the designated object are distinct. That's something to know. And that's what we, as sentient beings with minds covered by ignorance, see all the time. So Geltsep's Jay, concluding this, says, okay, if things existed from their own side, who with intelligence would hold that they are imputed by conceptuality? But the wise don't say that. Therefore, we should go with the wise. Let's go on to the next verse. So verse 179 is a little bit easier. Assertion. This is Job Low, who's Venerable's version of the Kachi, one mouth. The commentator against whom Geltsep Jay is giving his response. So Job Low says, since men and women are bound together by mutual desire, one cannot give up women and thus cannot give up desire. I think this is such a flimsy thing. Aryadeva says, none is, as it were, bound to another. It is unfeasible to separate that which is... It is unfeasible to separate that which is bound together. All right, I get it. Okay, none is, as it were, bound to another. It is unfeasible to separate that which is bound together. So, no man is intrinsically bound to a woman. No person is intrinsically bound to another person. If it were inherently so, it would be irrevocable, that binding. That's what this means. But clearly, that's not so. People divorce, people separate, people die. I mean, that's why it's just like flimsy. So Geltsep Jay uses as the example, like a black and white ox bound together by a yoke. Right? So you have a team of ox, a pair of oxen in the field, a black one and a white one. They have this yoke. They're bound together. For sure they are during the time that they have that yoke. But as soon as they get back home and they take the yoke off, they are no longer bound. Same thing with men, women, men, women, women, men. However, whatever combination you come up with, nobody is intrinsically bound to each other. There's no, even at the grossest level, there is no evidence of this. So, Joe Blow, too bad. She did say, though, this one is a tougher one. Craving, and Geltsep Jay does too, craving also binds sense objects and sense organs together. That one seems a little bit harder to separate. But in true, but they aren't intrinsically, inherently bound either. It's as if our sense organs are bound to that object and we want to continue to have contact with it. So even when we think we're like so attached to something we can never separate, we can. No matter how strong the addiction, really, that's what comes to mind. Because you think that you can never separate from this, but we can. Okay, verse 180. This verse is about the lack of contradiction in seeing many who have not abandoned afflictions. So Job Lowe says, okay, if afflictions are stopped by analyzing in this way, why do most people appear not to have abandoned them? Good question. In other words, if we analyze the object and see that not everybody reacts in the same way, okay, we've got that. You looked at conceptuality and see how you create things. You see that people are not inherently bound together. Then why are people still having affliction? Well, Geltsev's answer is, it's because they lack strong belief in the profound teachings. It's a good answer, actually. And at first I thought, well, that's kind of trite. But no, it's actually very, very powerful. So verse 80 is this very famous verse that we've seen everywhere. Those with little merit do not even doubt this doctrine. Entertaining just a doubt tears to tatters worldly existence. Entertaining just a doubt of things exist in the way they appear tears samsara to bits. What's interesting that it was in terms of merit. So, in other words, those with little merit just take things for granted as they are. You know, they never ask, who am I really? What is my mind? How do things really exist? It's like we never encounter even that question, much less something that can help us answer that question. And so it's not like, I mean, it's not like people are bad. We just don't, they don't have the merit to have the question arise. They don't have the good karma to have the question arise. Doesn't mean that that will always be so. No, people may meet the teachings, they may create the causes and so forth. But, so they may start asking those questions, but entertaining just a doubt, Aryadeva says, tears samsara to tatters. I find this very encouraging. I think, you know, I've seen this quote, we all have, I'm sure, seen this quote many times in many different places. And you always think, well, what does doubt really mean? I have thought that. Like, okay, how much doubt about cyclic existence do I have, or the appearance of reality do I have before my samsara starts to fall to tatters? How long does it take? How much do I need to know? But according to both Venerable Children's commentary and Geltsev's Jays, it's really clear that just having the doubt, any doubt that we have right now, helps. Why? Because it pushes us to explore, to know more. Even though we're doubt, we're confused, we don't know the vocabulary, we don't get it, it's hard, it's who wants to deal with this, it's, do I have to know this to be a good Buddhist? Whatever resistance has come up in our mind, but still, if we keep bringing our mind to it, that propels us to explore, to get curious, to start to question. Are things really like that then? Would my teacher tell me that they're not if they weren't? Would the Buddha have told us they're, like, would he have taught this? And so it's true. Venerable said, most people don't ever think about these things. I don't know, maybe for you, but certainly in the household I grew up in, nobody ever said, what do you think the nature of reality is, honey? Nobody even thought about it. So if you don't have any thought about, is this the nature of reality, or even, I mean, we may have the thought about why do we suffer, but the answers that we get are pretty insufficient. And you just buck up or buckle under, whichever your personality tends you to, lends you towards, and on we go. So to just begin to question and then to have the merit that gives us the possibility to receive the teachings that help us do some reasoned analysis on this, sure, it tears samsara to tatters. Not today. But already, we begin to doubt, we begin to question. Our reality changes a little bit. Our experience changes, not our reality. Our experience changes a bit. And I think we can attest to that here. So when emptiness is taught, simply entertaining a positive doubt that it might be like this tears samsara to tatters. Then, by ascertaining, so somewhat positive doubt, okay, that's positive doubt, will seek certainty. By ascertaining the correct view through using reasoning and scriptural quotations, then eventually we'll gain inference into the nature of reality. Through inference, continuing to reflect on it, meditate on it, you'll gain direct perception. We will meditate on that direct perception repeatedly, cleanse the mind of all defilements, and attain liberation. Thus, liberation can be attained. So if we have some conviction about that, we'll go for it. Interesting point. Venerable said, we've been in samsara since beginningless time. I don't know if you ever stopped to think about how long that is, but that's a long time. When, in how many lives, have we ever heard about the Dharma or investigated the nature of reality? Some, for sure, or we wouldn't be sitting here. But not a lot, or we wouldn't be sitting here. So just thinking about it, she said, it's something quite special, and you'll see how extremely rare and precious it is. And I was thinking too, long ago for Rinpoche, when we did the Manjushri retreat, I was studying up on something, and I found something, I can't tell you where I saw it, but I wrote it out and put it on the bulletin board for the Manjushri retreat. Lama Zopa Rinpoche said, even you just think the word emptiness. Even you just walk around and think, are things empty or not? Even just that level of wondering opens the door to the wisdom that will ultimately understand the nature of reality completely. It was so reassuring. So to take our mind to it again and again and again. So that's where the next verse goes to. Verse 181, advice to understand the meaning of emptiness. It's about advice to take interest in the meaning of the fundamental mode of existence. Verse 181, the subduer said of this doctrine, there will be increase until liberation. Anyone who lacks interest in it clearly has no sense. From the first moment of the path of seeing, from the time we have direct perception of emptiness, from that moment until you attain liberation or full awakening, there will be no decline and only increase in your direct perception of emptiness. You can't go back. You can only deepen, 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 deepen. All other virtuous qualities that you practice together from that time on will also increase. Meaning that when we practice generosity from that time on, conjoined with wisdom, then the merit that comes from that is just enormous. Practicing our ethical conduct, practicing fortitude, conjoined with that wisdom that realizes the ultimate nature, then the merit just only grows and grows and grows and grows and grows too. So from that moment on, when we enter the path of seeing, it's like, I mean, it may be three countless gradients, but phew, on you go. And as Chöngsi Chögyal Rinpoche was teaching in Precious Garland, which I hadn't really thought about, but he talked a lot about the Bodhisattva deeds, and Nagarjuna talks about the fact that You know, once you have this level of awareness and the level of bodhicitta, then your life is all joy and bliss anyway. So this idea about continuing to suffer in samsara, forget it. You don't suffer anymore. So we can only move forward here. Therefore, at this point where we are right now, anyone who lacks interest in understanding the meaning of emptiness clearly has no sense. It's kind of self-evident. If this is the method to increase our good qualities, to lead us from this miserable world where we're thrown around by our afflictions, subjected to birth, aging, sickness, and death, if we have no interest in learning about this, she had a great analogy. Venerable says it's like someone who has a curable disease having no interest in taking the medicine that will cure you. I've known people like that, actually. Actually, you probably know a lot. I don't want to be that kind of person. Therefore, Gyaltsev J says, the wise should take an interest in thinking about emptiness. Where does this worldly practices come to an end? Yeah, to see what this is. Ah, it's in his quote. The wise should take an interest in contemplating emptiness. Worldly practices come to an end once they have yielded their fruit. But the understanding of emptiness leads the practices of giving and so forth to the city of omniscience. So, we make good, you know, we do virtuous actions with our worldly understanding, you know, with a, you know, a good motivation, but it's still propelled by our underneath it all, we're still grasping a true existence. So the merit can only ripen in worldly ways, and it runs out. But understanding emptiness makes all of these practices the very cause of our full awakening. This contemplation of emptiness is like, oh, this is how Venerable rewrote it. The contemplation of emptiness is like chocolate. It should always be savored. Okay. So then Joe Blow goes on to the next verse, 182.
Can you, you know, the example of how to practice the six parameters in the context, in combination with reflecting about emptiness, can you give an example? Not everybody here might know that. I mean, oh, I'd like to hear that again, too. Now, how you proceed if you yourself practice generosity or you yourself practice ethical conduct, whatever, how do you practice it in combination with reflection about emptiness?
Yeah, so you always apply the circle of three.
Yes.
So you recognize that you yourself as the giver are not inherently existent, that you're empty of inherent existence or arise dependently, that the object that you're giving is also empty of inherent existence, of the receiver is also empty of inherent existence, and that these three are also mutually dependent. There is no giver without a receiver, without a gift. You know, all of those things arise dependently. So holding that in mind, especially for those of us who don't really know what that means, it's good to bring it to mind. It's helpful. And that's true for all six. Yeah. Okay, so where was I? Question, Joe Blow. Does one meditate on emptiness although things are not empty to free oneself from desire? Or does one view them that way because they actually are empty of true existence? You get that question?
No.
The question is, even though things aren't really empty of inherent existence, do you meditate on this and pretend that they are so you get over your desire? Or are they really empty of inherent existence? That's the question. The translation from the book is different from what we got in our handout. Different. One does not regard that which is not empty as empty, thinking thereby to gain nirvana. The Tathagatas say that nirvana will not be attained through wrong views. So, the explanation of this is that it could happen that some people misunderstand what emptiness is and think it means total non-existence. I mean, we're always warned about that. So they could think, oh well, things aren't really empty, but you can pretend they are in order to release attachment, and that will lead you to liberation. So that's a, you know, it's a wrong view. It's cultivating a wrong view that doesn't really go anywhere. So in paraphrasing Gyaltsep Jay, I think this is what Venerable's doing. Once you have an understanding of that which is empty as empty, then you familiarize yourself with that. It's not that you regard what isn't empty as empty, thinking that that will lead, somehow lead to liberation. This reminded me a little bit, I don't know if this will work for people, but you know how people really have a hard time hearing the teaching about regarding the body as foul, that our minds conceive it as something pure and beautiful, but if you really analyze the body, it's it's full of snot, it's pretty stinky, and it's full of, you know, every orifice we have produces something that's not pleasant and that you don't want to do in public or anything like that. But people always say, oh, that teaching is just for monks, so they'll maintain their celibacy. Right? It's kind of like this way of thinking is the same kind of view. Like, oh, this isn't really true, but it's told for some reason. So, oh, things aren't really empty, but we're teaching emptiness so that we'll get over our attachment. And that will liberate me. So that's what they were saying. So the answer is, if your problem is ignorance, you have to generate the wisdom that is the opposite of ignorance to be liberated. And Gyaltsep Jay said, finally, no matter which of the three vehicles nirvana you aspire for, whether the cure vehicle, the solitary realizer vehicle, or the bodhisattva vehicle, you must learn the meaning of emptiness to attain it. So this is the last verse I wanted to get to tonight. Verse 183, showing the means to turn away from samsara. Okay, so we've gotten clear about the afflictions, objects are not stable. We talked about two kinds of conceptuality. We talked about how even doubting the nature of existence tears samsara apart. So then we come to this question where Job Low says, if things are empty, it's appropriate to teach suchness. What's the use of teaching how the world of sentient beings and environments come into existence? In other words, why do we have to learn the 12 links of dependent arising? Why do we have to learn about karma? Why do we have to learn about all this stuff if understanding emptiness is the key to liberation? Just teach me the big stuff. Let's go for it. So, verse 183. Whatever contains teaching about the world speaks of engagement. Whatever contains elucidation of the ultimate speaks of disengagement. So the emptiness, the lack of inherent existence, can't be understood without first understanding how samsara comes into being. That's one point. So the scriptures, the Buddha, taught how ignorance causes karma. We just went through it. How ignorance causes action, which brings consciousness, and so forth. Consciousness leads to name and form, six sense sources, the whole 12 links of how things arise. So scriptures that teach about how we take rebirth in samsara, all of that is this first part of the verse about teachings about engagement. And without understanding that, it will be very, very difficult to understand emptiness, ever. Why? First, it helps us to develop renunciation. If we don't study the Four Noble Truths and don't understand how ignorance and anger and attachment create our karma, If we don't really meditate on how karma brings the unsatisfactory conditions that we experience, then we won't have any wish to be free of it. If we don't spend a lot of time thinking about that, then we won't bother. And if we don't have any interest in that, then we won't try to get out. So emptiness might become an intellectual exercise, an academic pursuit, the teachings on emptiness. But they're not, well, you can't get it in terms of liberation without understanding what's underneath that, how we got here. Venerable's analogy is, if you don't know how you got into prison, and you think prison's kind of nice, there's no reason to try to get out. The other reason we study is it helps us refute wrong conceptions regarding arising and production. This is important. I didn't really leave enough time for this. But I think we'll go into it briefly. So we have to refute these three wrong conceptions to understand emptiness. As long as we have these gross conceptions about how our predicament of being born in samsara came about, we will never understand the subtler level. So the three misconceptions that we're trying to counteract are that our lives are produced by an external creator. That's one. That our lives are causeless and random. And that that our lives are produced by a discordant cause. And, you know, these conceptions are like totally alive in our world today, all around us and in our environment and in our society. So, you know, a lot of us grew up with this creator, God. Mm-hmm. How'd I get here? God made you, honey. In his image. So, we may not have used the word permanent when we think about what we were taught about God or what is taught about God. But when you ask, who made God? Nobody. God's always been there. That's the answer. Alpha and Omega, world without end. God has always been there, unchanging, right? So there's a permanent thing, okay? A permanent, unchanging thing that's always been there, but created something. Created the world in 7 days, in fact, our story, but created something. So the act of creation requires change. But we have this permanent being, unchanging, who's always been there, who's also kind of changing to do the creation. So that doesn't hold up. If God created, then God changed. Then God is not permanent, which means God is influenced by causes and conditions, just like everything else. If God is influenced by causes and conditions, then God is other-powered, just like everything else, right? God cannot be. A God that is influenced by causes and conditions cannot be omnipotent. You can't just have always been there, create the things you want when you want it, and stay unchanged and unaffected by causes and conditions. So it doesn't hold up. So when we learn about the 12 links of dependent arising and get an idea that everything that functions and arises does so due to causes and conditions, we see that there cannot be some kind of permanent creator. So this other question that comes up about God, you know, is like, then why did God create suffering? Why does this all-loving, all-compassionate God create suffering? But then if we see that all 8 sufferings come from karma and come from afflictions and come from ignorance, then we also see there's no creator deity. So that's one of the reasons for teaching the 12 links, you know, to help dispel this. So that's one wrong view we need to spend some time with. We need to get out of our mind and see where we have it, because this is something that's really, you know, endemic to our culture. But if we're going to realize emptiness, we have to get rid of that idea. We have to really get rid of that idea. And we do it by meditating on causes and conditions, by causality, and convincing ourselves that everything that arises, all impermanent phenomena, arise due to causes and conditions. Okay, the second wrong conception that we're refuting here is that our existence is random and without causes. And that just doesn't make sense. I mean, we people think that. And it's easy to go there. If you give up God, then we don't have any much option. Oh, okay, if there's no God, if there's no manager of the universe, then everything is just wildly chaotic and random. So you become a nihilist for a while. Hopefully not long, but people can go there. It's an easy way to flip your mind. But if we think about that, if things were random, why do we eat to end our hunger? And it says, why do we put gas in the car to make it go? If we didn't live by cause and effect in a physical way, we wouldn't do anything. We live as though we believe in causality because that's how things are. But our mind can conceive, oh, things are just random. So by studying this, we learn that our lives and our suffering are not causalist, they are not random. Or this idea that it's just luck, you know, oh, this person just had good luck for being born in this nice family, this person just had good luck because they got this promotion. We see that that's, you know, that kind of random luck or bad luck, rotten luck because this person got cancer. It's not that. We see that things will arise due to causes and conditions, and so it's not random. So again, if we're going to realize emptiness, we have to get rid of that idea, that things come about without a cause. And then the last one, that things come about due to discordant causes, like one cosmic mind. We're all one great ocean of love, and we rise out of the ocean of love and fall back into the ocean of love. And we all come from the goddess, and to her we shall return like a drop of rain returning to the ocean. I sang that song many times. And this is an interesting point. Venerable said that the way society is going in terms of materialism, we're kind of going towards that view. In terms of, like, okay, our body and your neurons and genes, of course, influence our thinking. But as a society, we're giving biology and brain chemistry all this power in explaining why we experience what we do. I think we've heard it. We debated it here with guests that have come, right? That, you know, our experience is just a product of the chemical and electrical activities of our brain. But, so that's a discordant cause here. Not that the mind is dependent on the activity of the brain. It's not that our experience is dependent on those things. So you could say that believing in biological factors as the sole cause of our existence is also a wrong view that we need to dispel, and it falls right into this idea of discordant causes. So we need to get rid of the notion that things can't possibly cause the effect, will cause the effect. We need to get rid of that idea. So these kinds of meditations, she said, just thinking about causes and conditions on any level and broadening it out to as many aspects of our lives will provoke change. And that's the whole teaching on dependent arising, or the foundational teaching on dependent arising, is this thing of causal dependence. So, you know, we can end with that, with Aryadeva's letting us know that whatever contains teaching about the world speaks of engagement. Those teachings about the world, those method side of the path, are absolutely essential to understanding the ultimate. And understanding the ultimate is essential to get out of cyclic existence. And the more we think about things in terms of dependent arising, the more we understand how cyclic existence works, how we can get out, and so we're really inspired and propelled to study the wisdom aspects that will help us be liberated. And if we follow the same thinking of the Mahayana path, when we look at our dependence on other living beings, see what a recipient of kindness we are, how that we cannot exist without each other, then we will, of course, determine that we cannot leave cyclic existence without bringing everybody else with us. So, that's
as far as we got in chakra.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forever.